Some people believe that intimacy and sexual intimacy with another may be the thing. Well, Solomon had 700 wives in addition to 300 concubines, and if sex, adoration, and human intimacy was the great ultimate, well, look, no one in history was better placed to discover it. But Solomon himself writes that it actually, in the end, turns out to be emptiness.
This is Mission 66, brought to you by TWR and the Bible Teaching Ministry of Dr. Luis Seau. Today we dive into the reign of King Solomon, the temple builder, in the book of 2 Chronicles. God's provision and man's unfaithfulness are on display as John Matthews and Esther Sisulu take us through each chapter. You can follow along with your downloadable study guide at mission66.org. Let's begin.
We continue today in the second book of Chronicles, and we'll learn more about the history of God's people in the Old Testament as Solomon undertakes one of the most remarkable construction projects that's talked about in the Bible. Well, our teacher John Matthews will lead us through chapters 1 through 4 with the theme, The Wisdom of Solomon.
Esther, thank you very much, and a very warm welcome to Mission 66, wherever you join us from today, and indeed, whatever your situation, you are so welcome here. Thank you for your company. And we're currently at a fascinating part of the Old Testament. It's known as the Books of Chronicles 1 and 2, and it includes the account of all the kings of Judah. And at the end of the first book of Chronicles, we saw King David passing the baton to his son Solomon, who would succeed him as king of Israel. Now, David knew that his son was going to be the one to build this grand construction, this grand temple in Jerusalem. And so he begins, does David, preparing ahead of time. So he gathers building materials and he takes freewill offerings from the people. And so here in 2 Chronicles, where we're at today, it begins by telling us that Solomon, son of David, established himself in his kingdom, for the Lord his God was with him and made him exceedingly great. He had personal contact with all his commanders and officers and judges, and he made 1,000 sacrificial burnt offerings on the altar that the craftsmen had made. And then verse 7 happens. Take a listen to this. In that night, God appeared to Solomon, and he said to him, "Ask what I shall give you." And Solomon said to God, "You have shown great and steadfast love to David my father, and have made me king in his place. O Lord God, let your word to David my father now be fulfilled, for you have made me king over a people as numerous as the dust of the earth. Give me now wisdom and knowledge to go out and come in before this people, for who can govern this people of yours, which is so great?" And God answered Solomon, saying, "Because this was in your heart, and you have not asked for possessions or wealth, honour, or the life of those who hate you, and have not even asked for long life, but have asked for wisdom and knowledge for yourself, that you may govern my people over whom I have made you king. Wisdom and knowledge are granted to you. I will also give you riches, possessions, and honour such as none of the kings had who were before you, and none after you shall have the like." So Solomon came from the high place at Gibeon from before the tent of meeting to Jerusalem, and he reigned over Israel. I wonder what I would have asked for, or I wonder what you would have asked for, if God allowed you to ask for whatever you want. Well, Solomon here has that opportunity. And what does he ask for? Well, he asks God for wisdom. And that greatly pleases God. And as a result, Solomon not only is given wisdom as none before him, but he's also to be given great prosperity. And the text says that silver and gold were as common in Israel as paving stones in the days of Solomon. And he's able to expand this great trade network with the nations around him. And, you know, in truth, it never got any better for Israel than these days of David and then Solomon. David had expanded and consolidated the borders of the kingdom. And now under Solomon, it was to reach a level of prosperity and development that had never been seen before. And the text at the end of the first chapter lists the 1,400 chariots, 12,000 horses that were imported from Egypt and from Cilicia, and then sold them to all the kings of the Hittites and of the Arameans. And this is where chapter 2 begins, with the building of the temple. And that dominates, in fact, much of the narrative concerning Solomon's life as recorded here in the Book of Chronicles, and many other aspects of Solomon's reign mentioned in the Book of Kings. They don't actually appear here in Chronicles, because the focus in Chronicles is different from what is seen in Kings. So let's get into chapter 2, and this is what it tells us. Now, Solomon purposed to build a temple for the name of the Lord and a royal palace for himself. And Solomon assigned 70,000 men to bear burdens and 80,000 to quarry in the hill country and 3,600 to oversee them. And Solomon sent word to Hiram, the king of Tyre, saying, "As you dealt with David, my father, and sent him cedar to build himself a house to dwell in, so deal with me. Behold, I am about to build a house for the name of the Lord my God and dedicate it to him for the burning of incense, of sweet spices before him, and for the regular arrangement of the showbread, and for burnt offerings morning and evening on the Sabbaths and the new moons and the appointed feasts of the Lord our God as ordained forever for Israel. The house that I am to build will be great, for our God is greater than all gods. But who is able to build him a house, since heaven, even highest heaven, cannot contain him? Who am I to build a house for him, except as a place to make offerings before him? So now, send me a man skilled to work in gold, silver, bronze, and iron, and in purple, crimson, and blue fabrics, trained also in engraving, to be with skilled workers who are with me in Judah and Jerusalem, whom David my father provided. Send me also cedar, cypress, and algum timber from Lebanon, for I know that your servants know how to cut timber in Lebanon, and my servants will be with your servants to prepare timber for me in abundance. For the house I am to build will be great and wonderful. I will give for your servants the woodsmen who cut timber 20,000 cores of crushed wheat, 20,000 cores of barley, 20,000 baths of wine, and 20,000 baths of oil." Quite an offering, isn't it? Solomon keeping up the good relations here which Hiram had had with his father David. And the woodcutters and the stonecutters of Tyre and Sidon, they were famous for their skill. And verse 11 says that Hiram, king of Tyre, answered in a letter that he sent to Solomon, saying, "Because the Lord loves his people, he has made you king over them." Hiram also said, "Blessed be the Lord God of Israel, who made heaven and earth, who has given King David a wise son, who has discretion and understanding, who will build a temple for the Lord and a royal palace for himself. Now, I have sent a skilled man who has understanding, Huram Abi, the son of a woman of the daughters of Dan, and his father was a man of Tyre. He is trained to work in gold, silver, bronze, iron, stone, and wood, and in purple, blue, and crimson fabrics and fine linen, and to do all sorts of engraving and execute any design that may be assigned him. With your craftsman, the craftsman of my lord, David, your father. Now, therefore, the wheat and barley, oil and wine of which my lord has spoken, let him send to his servants, and we will cut whatever timber you need from Lebanon and bring it to you in rafts by sea to Joppa, so that you may take it up to Jerusalem. And this is exactly how the timber was delivered from what is now the country of Lebanon all the way south to Jerusalem. It was floated down the Mediterranean coast to Joppa, and then Solomon would have it hauled up from the coast to the city. And it says that he put all the resident aliens in Israel to work, 70,000 to bear burdens, 80,000 to quarry stones in the hill country, and 3,600 as overseers to make the people work. Imagine the scale of this workforce dedicated to this really extraordinary project. And then in chapter 3, the actual construction of the temple begins. That was in the fourth year of Solomon's reign, which was approximately 966 BC. Verse 1 says, "Then Solomon began to build the house of the Lord in Jerusalem on Mount Moriah, where the Lord had appeared to David his father at the place that David had appointed on the threshing floor of Ornan the Jebusite." Now, this site where David had been punished for conducting a census of Israel, you might remember that. And the threshing floor of Ornan was also called the threshing floor of Aruna in other places. And actually, another little known fact, Esther, is that Mount Moriah was the exact same place where Abraham was tested. You might remember that when he was told to sacrifice his son Isaac on an altar, and God stopped him from going ahead with that sacrifice because it was a test to see if Abraham would obey. By the way, Mount Moriah, not the same location as Calvary, where God offered up his only begotten son, Jesus, on the cross. But they are actually near to each other, and the parallel is clear, isn't it? So the foundations of the temple were 60 cubits long, 20 cubits wide. That's about 27 meters long and 9 meters wide. So not enormous, but the temple was meticulously designed and adorned. And the text details its gold-plated interior, artistic carvings, images of cherubim, and the craftsmanship involved in its construction. The Holy of Holies, where the Ark of the Covenant was going to be placed, was overlaid with 21 tons of pure gold. Even the nails were made of gold. And now in verse 15, we see that Solomon made two pillars to adorn the front of the temple, 35 cubits high, with a capital on top of 5 cubits each. And he made chains like a necklace, putting them on top of the pillars. And he made 100 pomegranates and put them on the chains. And the south pillar he called Jachin, and the north pillar he called Boaz. And the two pillars were meant to represent Solomon and his father, King David. Now, Jachin means God enables. And you might remember Boaz being the guy who married Ruth, and they were in David's genealogy. And chapter 4 then, Esther, as we move on, shifts its focus to the temple furnishings, the bronze altar for burnt offerings, the sea, or effectively giant bowl for ceremonial washing, which was made of cast metal and was supported by 12 carved bulls. Then you had these 10 basins, 10 gold lampstands, 10 tables, the priest's courtyard, and indeed other sacred implements. And these elements underscore the reverence toward God and just the sense of, well, the meticulous effort that Solomon undertook in doing what he did in this temple, which became known as one of the seven wonders of the ancient world. And then finally, the text concludes in 2 Chronicles. Here we go, chapter 5, verse 1. It says, "Thus all the work that Solomon did for the house of the Lord was finished. And Solomon brought in the things that David his father had dedicated and stored, the silver, the gold, and all the vessels in the treasuries of the house of God. So here you have Solomon granted wisdom and so much more by God.
You're listening to Mission 66, and of course we're here with our teacher John Matthews, and I'm Esther, and today marks the beginning of the second book of Chronicles, and we're looking through chapters 1 all the way to 4. Now John, as usual, I do have a few questions and observations, and let's start off with this observation. Now Solomon wasn't a man of war like his father, right? But we see here that he seems to have this deep understanding of politics and diplomacy back in his time. Let's talk about that.
Which is probably the exact reason that he wasn't a man of war, isn't it? Because he has this deep understanding of diplomacy and politics. So that, I've no doubt that his discernment was the reason. Well, of course it was the reason that his days were days of peace. And my goodness, is there something for us to learn from that in our world today? He has this wisdom and discernment that comes straight from the heart of God. And so you're right, Esther, during Solomon's reign, Israel becomes a major regional power, including economic growth and trade, not by force, but by discernment. Isn't that so different to what we see today? And the text mentions immense wealth, silver and gold in abundance. We also read about his large number of horses and chariots, which are imported from Egypt and Cilicia region, likely up near Asia Minor, present-day Turkey. And these he sold actually to Syria and to the Hittite territories at a handsome profit. And so this prosperity is greatly enhanced by decades of peace. And the absence of war allows Solomon to concentrate on building this network of trusted trading partners. And you know what? You know, you mentioned diplomacy there, and Solomon knew so well the power of the tongue, when to speak, but more importantly, when to remain silent. And this meant that he was highly skilled at managing relationships, more than others before him and more than many after him. So they simply hadn't the wisdom to apply to tricky border relationships, factioning groups and so on. But Solomon is different. He knows the power of tone. He knows the power of words said, words unsaid, and the right words said. He knows the power of the tongue, the power of words. And so what is he? Well, he's a brilliant, wise communicator. In fact, it was Solomon himself who writes in Proverbs chapter 10, "When there are many words, sin is unavoidable. But the one who controls his lips is prudent." Isn't that challenging, Esther? Sometimes we talk far too much. So many words that mean very little. Solomon in Proverbs 10 says, many words eventually makes sin unavoidable. Because we can't help ourselves. Gossip, slander, things that aren't just maybe irrelevant. But he goes on to say, the one who controls his lips is prudent. There's another expression, isn't there? Silence is golden. And how wise that is in a world of noise.
Well, we are definitely seeing the effects of Solomon's wisdom in play. And I actually think about one of those trusted trading partners, Hiram, the king of Tyre, right? And he's continuing this establishment of the relationship that King David began. But speaking of this king of Tyre, you know, he says these words, "Blessed be the Lord, the God of Israel." Did he eventually convert to worship the true God?
Look, it's not necessarily a declaration that of Hiram's faith. I think he's just being polite, actually. Hiram and the Phoenicians, they were Baal worshippers, polytheists. But Hiram has a good relationship with David. And at the time, even other world leaders would recognize and see clearly the blessing that Israel had as a result of their God. Tyre and Sidon, well, they prospered greatly, didn't they, in the end, from their alliance with Israel. So they may well have recognized that these blessings clearly stem from a divine source or something like that. So there was certainly a respect.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's good. Well, you know, now for the benefit of our listeners, let's differentiate between the temple and the tabernacle.
Yeah, let's do that. Well, look, the tabernacle was portable, was a building in a fixed location. The tabernacle was actually a large tent with poles and coverings of woven material which could be disassembled and moved whenever God said to move. And whenever they stopped, the tabernacle would then be reassembled. And it was the tribe of Levi who had the responsibility to take down, carry everything, and then put up the tabernacle in a new spot. But both the tabernacle and the temple represented God's presence amongst his people. But the tabernacle, well, that was mobile, symbolizing that God was going to be with Israel through their wanderings, through their journey. But the temple, on the other hand, emphasized the centrality of worship and the significance then of Jerusalem as God's city.
You know, I know we've touched upon this in some previous episodes, but for those that are wondering, when we look at the story of the Israelites and them wandering in the wilderness, how did they know when to move? Because we know that God's presence was with them.
Well, there was a pillar of cloud that hovered over the Holy of Holies. And when that pillar of cloud moved, well, then they knew that it was time to take down the tabernacle and follow the cloud. It was one of, Esther, those miracles that accompanied the Israelites in the wilderness. But it became commonplace because it was a daily, it was whenever the time was right to move, then the pillar would move. So it did become commonplace.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. They perhaps became used to this exercise, if you will, of putting the tabernacle up and then putting it down. But I suppose, you know, they knew that this wasn't God who actually lived in this temple or the tabernacle, right?
I think so, because Solomon himself acknowledges, even here in this account in Chronicles, that no temple could ever fully contain the true God, who is greater than the heavens and the earth. So he's emphasizing it here. Perhaps there was a time in the wilderness where some of the Israelites weren't so clear on that. Certainly we understand, don't we, from some of those battles with the Philistines that they, when they took the tabernacle, believed that they were able to contain God within that. So they didn't understand it. But certainly by this stage, Solomon is just recognizing that nothing can contain God, because he is all powerful and omnipresent. That means he's everywhere at the same time. So the temple is symbolic. It's a place where God's glory was manifest, but it's not his location. Yes, he was there, but he was everywhere else too. Unlike the Canaanite gods, who were supposedly dependent upon their temples, if you tore down your enemy's temple, well, that effectively meant that you had defeated their God.
Where did the Israelites keep the furniture while the temple was being built?
When Solomon became king, the tabernacle was most recently constructed or set up in Gibeon, which was a place associated with King Saul. Gibeon became the main religious center until the temple was finished. So that is where all the tabernacle furniture was kept, except for the Ark of the Covenant, which David had already moved to Jerusalem. That item, David felt, should be in the place where he had his throne.
Okay, something that really struck me that we read in chapter 1. We see God here is giving Solomon this extraordinary offer, right? He says, ask me whatever you want. Can you imagine? It kind of feels like a blank check offer, doesn't it?
Well, yeah, that's right. And he could. Esther have asked for absolutely anything. Yeah. But to his credit, really, he puts the kingdom that he's in charge of first, ahead of his own comforts. And so he asks for wisdom to lead properly. And he therefore gets not only wisdom, which is still talked about today, but he gets a lot more, including enormous wealth on top of that.
Well, how wise was Solomon? You know what I mean? I ask this because I wonder what the measure of his wisdom is. Well, how can we measure Solomon's wisdom?
Yeah, not something that can be measured, is it, effectively, quantitatively? But look, Esther, let's put it this way. The wisdom that he was asking for was the wisdom to govern people. Well, that alone would have taken some pretty important discernment to recognise, to ask for that. So that base wisdom must have been inside him of already. But in addition to the affairs of state, which were considerable, Solomon still finds time to be a student. And isn't that wise as well? He was an explorer, an investigator. The book of Proverbs contains many of Solomon's words to the wise, in which he wrote things like, "The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom." He also wrote, "Get wisdom. It is the most important thing of all. It will keep you from the many sinful pursuits that plague humanity." Now, I'm really looking forward to getting to the book of Proverbs later here on Mission 66, because it is a treasure trove of brilliant wisdom and knowledge based largely on the wisest man who ever lived, Solomon's experience. And where did his wisdom come from? It certainly wasn't innate. It came from the heart of God. So Proverbs is a book full of divine wisdom. So looking forward to getting there. And he had this ability, did Solomon, to read human nature. And we will get the benefit of that wisdom when we get to Proverbs. And of course, that was given to Solomon by he who created human nature, God.
Yeah, John, I certainly share your enthusiasm getting to the book of Proverbs. It's a fantastic, fantastic book indeed. But we know that Solomon also wrote the book of Ecclesiastes, which we will also get to eventually.
We will. Solomon, you know, lived in a peaceful time, and that meant he had some time to learn about the world. And because he was so wealthy, he had the money to do whatever his heart desired. And actually, you know, there was an element that was counterproductive for him, because he ends up trying and chasing after everything that mankind chases after: money, success, power, sexual pleasure, to report on what he finds. And after attaining everything that this world considers to be the ultimate, he found that it all of it, and I can't think of anyone else in history almost who had the opportunity to sample everything and anything as Solomon did, he found that it all leads to one thing: vanity, emptiness. So you climb the mountain of success and you find that at the top, there's nothing there. And some people believe that intimacy and sexual intimacy with somebody else may be the thing that brings ultimate happiness. And there must have been some of this in Solomon, because he had 700 wives in addition to 300 concubines. And if sex, adoration, human intimacy was the great ultimate in human experience, nobody in history was better placed to discover it than Solomon. But look what he writes. He writes that it actually eventually turns out to be emptiness and vanity. And so, through all this experience, he concludes Ecclesiastes. And so, with all this experience and wisdom and knowledge, he, Solomon, concludes Ecclesiastes with one exhausted sentence when he says, "Here is the sum of the matter. Fear God and keep his commandments. This is the whole duty of man." Coming from the guy who's been there and done it all. And so he cuts to God's incredible offer of salvation. Do that, he says, because you will end up skipping a whole load of trouble. And if you, like many of us, haven't skipped a whole load of trouble through life, but have stumbled upon and over mistakes and weaknesses, the same God, the same loving Heavenly Father, waits with open arms and says, come to me, you who are weary and heavy burdened, and I will give you rest. And that rest will last forevermore.
Well, thank you so much, John, for those encouraging words. And that indeed is a great start to this book of Second Chronicles. Friend, I hope that you'll stay with us now as we do have a summary of these four chapters that we've read, and it's coming up next.
So the theme is the wisdom of Solomon. King David, knowing his son Solomon would build the temple in Jerusalem, had gathered materials and encouraged offerings. And when Solomon becomes king, he asks God for wisdom to lead Israel, prioritizing the kingdom over personal gain. But God is pleased with what he's asked, and so grants him even more wisdom, wealth, and honor than he'd asked for. And so Solomon's reign becomes a golden age for Israel. It's marked by peace, prosperity, extensive trade, alliances, such as with Hiram, king of Tyre, that secures resources like cedar for the temple. And the temple, built on Mount Moriah, was a symbol of God's presence amongst his people. And it was ornate. Its construction showcased Solomon's dedication, the scale of his workforce. But Solomon's wisdom went way beyond governing well, because he also produces Proverbs and Ecclesiastes, which we'll get to here on Mission 66. And despite achieving all the worldly success that you could possibly imagine, Solomon still concludes that true fulfillment lies in fearing God and keeping his commandments. You know what? Nothing stops us from approaching and asking the same God for his wisdom here, today, now.
That is our teacher, John Matthews, leaving us on a word of wisdom here on Mission 66. And I want to thank you so much for joining us for this episode. Of course, we look forward to studying further with you in our book of Second Chronicles, so don't miss out. I'm Esther for John and our entire team. Until next time, may God bless you.
As Mission 66 comes to a close, be sure to download your free study guide at mission66.org. Deepen your daily devotion with insights from each episode, and let John and Esther lead you through the scriptures. Get your study guide at mission66.org and be prepared for our next episode. There, you can also connect with us, ask questions, or donate to help Mission 66's worldwide outreach. Head to mission66.org. Mission 66 is made possible through Transworld Radio in partnership with Dr. Luis Seau.